I walked up to the front of the classroom and reached into one of the two boxes lying on the teacher's desk. I pulled out a folded piece of paper, then reached into the other box and extracted another piece of paper from that one. I unfolded the first one, the one from the boys' box, and read it. How to build a birdhouse. I unfolded the girls' piece of paper. The first time I rode an elephant. I stared down at the two pieces of paper and sighed. I had to get the hell out of here. I was in my first week of classes of my ninth grade year at the Traverse City Junior High School. The junior high went through ninth grade, and then everybody switched to the senior high for the last 3 years of mandatory schooling, and my plan was to go to the Interlochen Arts Academy at that point. I figured I'd ride out the junior high with my friends and see it to its conclusion, and we'd part ways. But looking down at those two pieces of paper, I knew I wasn't going to make it. I was in public speaking, and I was supposed to give an impromptu speech based on one of the topics I had pulled from the boxes. One of the boxes was supposed to be things boys knew more about, and the other was supposed to be slanted in favor of girls. But I knew nothing about building birdhouses, and I'd certainly never ridden an elephant, and what 14-year-old girl had. I mumbled something about cutting six pieces of plywood to make a rectangular cube and drilling a large circular hole in one of them and gluing them together, et voila, a birdhouse. The teacher nodded and I took my seat. This had to be the lamest class in the entire junior high. And that was saying a lot. We had started class by taking seats in alphabetical order. Then, as a way to get to know each other, each of us stood up in order and said our name and something we liked that had the same initials as our name. Then the next person had to stand up and say what the name of everybody else before them was and what they liked, and add their name and like to the list. And we weren't allowed to write anything down. We had to do it from memory. I had it fairly easy, being near the front of the alphabet, and I could remember that Bobby Aardvark liked blowing antelope and Donald Dingleberry liked Dunkin' Donuts. Me, I like chocolate eclairs. But I felt sorry for Todd Weber, who once again got screwed because his last name happened to be at the end of the alphabet.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium.
Only Marvelous Marvin, the Nemonition, could remember the names of all 28 people and what they liked without writing anything down. So Todd did what he could, failed, and got a mark against him. Put, no doubt, on his infamous permanent record.
There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury and molybdenum and magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium. And cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium.
He also got busted during the impromptu speech exercise because he pulled playing baseball out of the boys' box and joked that there were two ways to do that and got sent to the office for his gentle innuendo. Poor Todd. He really didn't have a chance.
And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
Again. Step, kick, kick, leap, kick, touch. Again, step, kick, kick, leap, kick, touch.
Public speaking was the straw that broke this camel's back, but the ton of bricks that preceded it was a chorus line, which I had gone to see in Seattle just before returning to Michigan for the school that year. It struck such a deep chord in me, that longing to be someone, that desire to perform, to create, to rise above the faceless sea of humanity, hit me so hard that I burst into tears after the show. There's more to life than what I was forced to do at that lousy junior high, and there was more to me than I'd ever be able to develop there. I was invisible, which was the preferred state in junior high, where, like in Japan, the saying was, the nail that sticks out gets the hammer. But I didn't want to be invisible anymore. I wanted to be seen, and I sure as hell wasn't going to be seen surrounded by 850 ninth graders, making up a speech about riding an elephant and sharing my deepest desires to eat a chocolate eclair.
Stage left, boys. Let's do the ballet combination. First group of girls, second group follow.
So, despondent, I begged my mom to let me go to Interlaken for my freshman year. It was a scramble to get all the paperwork in, but she pulled some strings, and 3 weeks later, I was in my first class at the academy, excited to be on my way to bigger and better things. There was an awkward adjustment period, but I expected as much, so I put my head down and tried to run through it. But the awkward adjustment period lasted the entire year. And into the next year, too.
God, I really blew it. I really blew it. How could I do a thing like that?
How could I do a thing like that?
Now I'll never make it. I'll never make it. He doesn't like the way I look. He doesn't like the way I dance. He doesn't like the way I...
Finally, in the spring of my sophomore year, I had to admit that I was miserable. The problem wasn't the academy. I liked the work. I liked most of my teachers. I enjoyed getting the chance to explore my creative side with acting classes and photography classes and dance classes. I enjoyed being challenged by the academics, which were more rigorous and interesting than anything I had experienced before.
A 5, 6, 7, 8, up!
That was all good. The problem was that I didn't have any friends, and I wasn't going to get any because I was a day student. Interlaken is a boarding school, and 99% of the students lived in the dorms. There were a very few local kids, mostly faculty brats, that lived close enough to the campus that they could walk there in the morning and walk home after the last class finished in the evening.
Okay, girls, a 5, 6, 7...
But in a boarding school, friendships aren't made in class or at lunch. They're made in the dorm. That's where the real bonding took place. While everybody else had amazing adventures and deep conversations and shared the trials and tribulations and joys and heartaches of living away from home for the first time, I sat alone in my room at home and stared out the window. It was awful. I was unbearably lonely, and after a year and a half, I couldn't stand it anymore. So I sat down and had a long talk with my mom, and we agreed that I would move into the dorm the following year, my junior year, so I could finally become a proper part of the student body.
I've come this far, but even so, it could be yes, it could be no. How many people does he? I really need.
I have his
one and his one.
Please, God, I need.
Are you a
of a person I don't know? What does he want from me? What should I try to be? So many faces all around, and here we go. I need this job. Oh God, I need this show.
I was so excited. My mom tells the story about how I slept on my packed bags by the door the night before school opened that year. And though it wasn't quite like that, I was eagerly looking forward to it. Morning came, and I dragged my stuff over to Thor Johnson, the boys' dorm, and reported in for duty, eager to meet my roommate and get the year started. I checked in at the desk, eyeing all the other boys milling uneasily about, wondering which ones would become my friends. I introduced myself to the RA, and he looked up my name on his clipboard and gave me my room number, pointing out that it was on the second floor off to the left. Then he brightened up and said, "Hey, guess what?" I looked at him expectantly. "You got a single." He ran his finger down the sheet of paper. Yep, you're the only one who doesn't have a roommate. Lucky you. Lucky me. I couldn't believe it. The other boys at the desk looked at me jealously. I may have been the only one in the dorm without a roommate, but I was also probably the only one in the dorm that really wanted a roommate. I sighed and slung my bag up over my shoulder, took the key, and made my way upstairs to my new room. I spent the afternoon unpacking and decorating, my spirits brightening as I turned up the stereo and realized my mom wasn't going to be knocking on the door in 3 minutes asking me to turn it down. Although I was alone in the room, at least I was in the dorm, and I was sure to have a better shot at making friends here than across the street at my house. And if things ever got too hairy and I really needed a home-cooked meal and a maternal shoulder to lean on, it was within easy walking distance. The first week was a whirlwind of activity. I auditioned for the Level 3 dance class and, to my gratification and my mom's dismay, got in. I built my schedule around that morning block of dance and stood in the endless line at the bookstore, buying my textbooks and chatting with the other students. Most importantly, I met Eric, another dancer, and we hit it off immediately. We quickly became inseparable and made plans to become roommates after the mandatory one-month waiting period. Doing so, however, was an incredibly complicated maneuver, involving dozens of people and convoluted plans whereby this person goes over there and that person goes over there, but in order to get Jeff to be roommates with Charlie, then Charlie's roommate has to move in with Scott, but Scott's roommate wants to live with Alex, and so on ad nauseum. But eventually, thanks to a long series of negotiations, we finally had a plan all worked out. We just needed to wait until moving day in a couple of weeks, and everybody would get to go where they wanted. And then disaster struck. I was sitting in my room on a Sunday afternoon, listening to Gary Newman and leafing through my algebra homework, when there was a knock on the door. I I answered it, and there was an RA standing next to a tough-looking kid I hadn't seen before. "Good news, Chris," he said. "Here's your new roommate." He looked down at his clipboard. "Alan. Alan, meet Chris."
Day into night, she's with me. How sweet is her warm embrace.
We shook hands and I smiled, welcoming him into the room, but my heart sank. Now our plans were all messed up. Being a total jerk, I told him right away that I was planning on moving in with somebody else. "Yeah, nice to meet you too," he must have thought. But I started moving my stuff around to make room for him, clearing off half the desk and consolidating my books and records onto one half of the long shelf that ran the length of the room. Alan was a tuba player from Detroit and was one mean-looking son of a bitch. He was big, and he had a giant scar running down one side of his face. This, plus the fact that he had just fucked up my plans, instantly put me off of him. For his part, he found out that I was a dancer and immediately assumed I was gay and was going to try to jump his bones the second he let his guard down. It was a tense couple of days. One day, I was visiting my friend Andrew's room. Andrew was also a dancer, and I had known him from the previous year when I did a lot of tech work for the dance department, running the light board for performances, going on tour with them, and setting up the sound system and so on. And one of the things that endeared me to him was that he was the only person I had ever met who knew what Synergy was, and he had a couple of Jean-Michel Jarre records, so I knew he couldn't be all bad. Mostly bad, but not all bad. I had stopped by to chat, and he wanted to play me some music. He played me Leon Redbone, which I didn't really appreciate at the time, but grew to love years later. He played a little Boomtown Rats, claiming he had seen them in a concert in Denver, and that they had ruined I Don't Like Mondays with all of its elaborate production, and was much better in the stripped-down version he had heard them perform.
The silicon chip inside her head gets switched to overload. Nobody's gonna go to school today. She's gonna make them stay at home. Daddy doesn't understand it. He always said she was good as gold. And he can see no reasons, cause there are no reasons. What reason do you need to be shown? Tell me why. I don't like Mondays.
Tell me why.
I don't like Mondays.
Tell me why.
I don't like
see in the back of the city hall mind the dream of a girl about 13.
Then he pulled out a record and played this incredibly strange, incredibly funny song. It made absolutely no sense, musically or lyrically. The song kept starting and stopping and drastically changing tempos and genres.
Off with her clothes and into a bed where she tickles his fancy all night long.
There was lots of singing about shoes and TV dinners by the pool and smothering somebody's daughter in chocolate syrup. Somehow, Andrew knew it well enough to sing along, switching into falsetto and dancing to the jerky rhythms. The song was completely bewildering, sounding more like 20 different songs all cut up and randomly put back together than one single composition. Sometimes it was highly moody and experimental and sounded like Varese. Then it would slam into a burlesque sing-along, and then an avant-garde string quartet, and then an R&B workout. It was unlike anything I had ever heard, more like a Carl Stalling piece for Bugs Bunny than anything a band could actually pull off. He said it was by this guy, Frank Zappa, and was called Brown Shoes Don't Make It. I asked to borrow it, and he took it off the turntable, slipped it into its sleeve, and made me promise to take care of it and give it back in a week or so. I promised, and trotted it back upstairs to my room. I had heard of Frank Zappa. He was some legendarily weird musician that all the freakiest students at Interlochen seemed to like. You'd be walking down the hall and somebody would walk by you admonishing, "Watch out where those huskies go and don't you eat that yellow snow." Or, "I'm the slime oozing out of your TV set." Or something equally strange and provocative. And it would always turn out to be Zappa, man.
Until the lights to you are sold.
That's right, folks. Don't touch that dial.
He was the royal jester and voice of conscience, his hysterically funny music skewering everybody from the squares to the hipsters and calling hypocritical or foolish behavior, no matter which quarter it comes from.
They don't do no good. They never be working when they oughta should. They waste your time. They're wasting mine. California's got the most of them. Boy, they got a host of them. Swear to God, they got the most. And every business on the coast. Yeah, swear to God, they got the most. And every business on the coast. They got the flicks.
But more than just being a musical prankster, Zappa had an intense love of modern classical music. Two of his biggest heroes were Pierre Boulez and Edgar Varèse. Consequently, his music can be murderously difficult to play. He's written lots of classical music and spent great amounts of his own time and money trying to get them performed and recorded by symphony orchestras, and has invariably been disappointed by the poor attitudes and performances of professional classical musicians.
Swear to God, they got the most.
As I could, if my job would somehow be finished by Friday.
He had one moderate hit, Valley Girl, which was based on his daughter's scathing dinner table imitations of her San Fernando Valley classmates.
Like, oh my God!
Valley Girl!
Like, totally!
Valley Girl!
And Tino's, like, so bitchin'.
Valley Girl!
There's, like, the Galleria.
Valley Girl!
I'm, like, all these, like, really great shoe stores. I, like, love going into, like, clothing stores and stuff. I, like, buy the neatest mini skirts and stuff. Because, like, everybody's, like, super, super nice. Like, so bitchin'. Like,
Ventura, there you go. She just wants some bitchin' clothes. Tosses her head and cuts her hair. She got a whole bunch of nothing in there.
His brief experience in the bright public limelight disgusted him, and he happily went back to working the fringes of musical expression. He took on the hypocrisy of the PMRC, the musical censorship lobbying group formed by the uptight wives of powerful congressmen who felt that they shouldn't have to decide what was appropriate for their own children and wanted to legislate the country's morality based on their own puritanical ideas, and testified in Congress in what has to be one of the most entertaining statements on the congressional record. He was a great musician, a hysterically funny lyricist, and a fiercely intelligent and principled artist.
Jam in Joe's garage. His mama was screaming, "Turn it down!" We was playing the same old song in the afternoon, and sometimes we were playing all night long. It was all we knew, and easy too, so we wouldn't get it wrong, even if we played it on the saxophone.
And the world is a poorer place since his death.
We talked about keeping the band together. We figured that we should, 'cause about this time we was getting the eye from the girls in the neighborhood. They don't come over and dance around like.
A Monday warrior, mean, mean stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean, mean pride.
I got back to my room and greeted Alan. We'd warmed up a bit over the past week, but we weren't exactly friends. I had learned that he got his scar when, as a child, he was attacked by a dog that bit through his cheek and hadn't got it in a knife fight like I'd imagined. And he learned that, though I was a dancer, I wasn't gay and wasn't interested in getting it on with him, so our guards had been relaxed a bit. but we couldn't find much common ground. He begrudgingly put up with my new wave and synth pop, but his real musical loves were Journey and Rush, which I couldn't relate to very well. We were cordial to each other, but we were really just marking time until moving day. He had graciously agreed to go wherever we needed him to go to make our moving plans work out, so it was just a matter of time before we had to stop dealing with each other. I put the borrowed record on my turntable and queued up Brown Shoes Don't Make It.
Brown shoes don't make it. Brown shoes don't make it. Quit school. Why make it? Brown shoes don't make it.
TV dinner by the pool. He's a bummer every summer. Be a loyal plastic robot for a world that doesn't care.
Smile at every ugly. Shine on your shoes and cut your hair.
Be a jerk.
Go to work.
Be a jerk.
I listened to it all the way through, trying to get a handle on it, and when it was over, Alan, who had stopped reading and was staring at the turntable with mouth agape, said, "What the fuck was that?" It wasn't an irritated what the fuck, it was more of an amazed what the fuck. So I told him it was Frank Zappa, and I had borrowed it from a friend of mine. "Play it again," he said. So I queued it up and let it run.
If she were my daughter, I'd...
What would you do, Daddy?
If she were my daughter, I'd...
What would you do, Daddy?
If she were my daughter, I'd...
What would you do, Daddy?
Smother my daughter in chocolate syrup. Strap her on again.
Oh, baby.
This time, we were both giggling at its outrageous musical juxtapositions and the hysterical lyrics about doing the nasty on the White House lawn.
She's a teenage baby and she turns me off. I'd like to make her do a nasty on the White House lawn. Gonna smother my daughter in chocolate syrup and boogie till the cows come home.
When it was over, we smiled with the warmth of a shared secret, the ice between us completely broken. We played it a dozen times in a row, learning the lyrics and the strange changes, giddy with laughter. I had just queued it up again when there was a knock on my door. I opened it and let Eric into the room. He had stopped by to see if I wanted to go hang somewhere and was completely unprepared for the sight that met his eyes. Alan and I danced around the room, performing the bits of the song that we had figured out for Eric.
In a drawer in a desk box. The city hall mind, the dream of a girl about 13.
He must have thought we had lost our minds. But soon the gleeful weirdness of the song infected him too, and out of this unlikely event, Ace was born. For a while, Eric and I were friends, and Alan and I were friends, but Eric and Alan weren't really friends. But that eventually changed, and then the three of us became absolutely inseparable. After moving day, Alan started spending most of his time over in our room, and we soon evolved into Ace, taking the first letter of each of our names and vowing to stay best friends forever. We did everything together. Eat together, run around campus together, take the shopping bus into town together. Eric and I had a slightly stronger bond because of our dance classes, and because of the fact that we were roommates, and because there was just something magical between us. But Alan and I had intense conversations about art and life and the future, and we soon all became fast friends. I was ecstatic. I had finally gotten what I wanted out of Interlaken. I had the two best friends I had ever had. It was an amazingly strong and deep bond, and made my pre-Interlaken friendships pale in comparison. Not to put down my relationship with Mel and Lenore and Carl, my constant companions from fourth grade on, but something had soured in us after we went through the tumult of puberty. Sexuality reared its confusing head, and there were suddenly whole new layers of stuff between us that hadn't been there before. None of us really knew how to deal with it. Who does? And it put a great strain on our friendships. I said that I grew up physically with Mel and Carl and Lenore, but I grew up mentally and emotionally and artistically and socially with Eric and Alan, and that forged a deep and powerful bond between us. Ace was the place. It was where it was at. It was where I finally felt completely comfortable with all aspects of my personality. My intellectual interests, my creative passions, my hormonal questions, my odd musical tastes, my silly sense of humor. I was home. Not that it was all smiles and loving. We had arguments, and there were times I wanted to kill both of them, and they me, but that was all part and parcel of the package. You can't have the good without the bad, and the good so far outweighed the bad that it was easy to put up with. Even when Alan was doing his tiresome ape boy shtick and swinging around the room and pummeling us. What you gonna do? 'Cause you're an asshole. Even when Eric continued to knock the pyramid of Coke cans on the windowsill onto my bed while I was trying to sleep. Even when I was desperately trying to write a paper that was due the next day, and the two of them sat on Eric's bed and shot spitballs at me incessantly. I asked them nicely to stop. I asked them not so nicely to stop. I yelled at them. Finally, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I stormed out to the library where I could finish my writing in peace. The library was built under a large dome. A rotunda, with tables in a circle at the periphery of the dome. I took a seat at one of the tables, spread my notes out, and tried to concentrate on the symbolism of Billy Budd, or whatever the hell I was supposed to be writing about. Eric and Alan came into the library a few minutes later and took the table directly across the room from me.
Sir Richard Pumpelow,
you sniff the reeking buns of angels.
It was a well-documented oral phenomena that, sitting at opposite ends of the rotundas, there were three on campus, made the sound carry from one side to the other without losing any fidelity. While you couldn't hear the person sitting at the table next to you, somebody sitting directly across the room from you sounded like they were right in your ear. Eric and Alan knew this and started whispering to each other. That Earl is a total faggot. Ah, I know, he's a fucking idiot. Yeah, what a moron. Yeah, but his mom's hot. Oh, sure is. I'd do her. Oh, yeah, I'd make her scream. Ooh, baby.
Because you're an asshole, that's right. You're an asshole, yes, yes. You're an asshole, that's right. You're an asshole.
And so on until I started whispering back. You guys fucking suck. I hate both of you. I can't believe you're being such assholes. Which only made them redouble their efforts to totally drive me off my bean.
Well, ladies, you can be an asshole too.
Even then, I still forgave them, although barely, because the conversations were so good and the camaraderie was so satisfying.
But don't fool yourself, girl. It's looking at you. Don't fool yourself, girl. It's winking at you. Don't fool yourself, girl. It's blinking at you. That's why I say,
I'm gonna ram it, ram it, ram it, ram it up your poop shoe.
Cornhole!
Ram it, ram it, ram it, ram it up your poop shoe. Ram it, ram it, ram it, ram it up your poop shoe.
Wristwatch, Crisco.
Ram it, ram it, ram it, ram it up your poop shoe.
Don't fool yourself, girl. Going right up your poop shoe.
We'd run around campus together, swinging through the trees and crashing through the bushes. Alan would get a box of chocolate chip cookies sent to him from home every week, and we'd lie in the room, Alan in a sleeping bag on the floor, and eat cookies until we were sick. We'd play Name That Tune, and go to dances and air guitar the solos to My Sharona, and make up strange dances to Ultravox's Quiet Men. We would tease each other mercilessly and listen to each other confess our darkest secrets and our greatest fears. We were the best of all possible friends, indivisible, unconquerable. We were ace, and we owed our beginnings to Frank Zappa's exceptionally obscure, wondrously disjointed, hysterically funny, Brown Shoes Don't Make It. Of course, the impossible happened. The inseparable separated, and Ace broke up and followed their own paths. I still keep in touch with Eric, but I've long since lost track of Alan, who was married and working in a hotel in South Carolina, last I'd heard. Thank you. Years later, I was on a shuttle bus in Northampton, Massachusetts, waiting to be taken from Smith College back to Hampshire. I was sitting in the back, reading a book. There were a few people scattered throughout the other seats. An aggressively weird guy I had seen around before climbed into the shotgun seat. He was the sort of person that would go out of his way to be obtuse and irritating, apparently taking joy in watching people roll their eyes. He stared out the front window and started singing Brown Shoes Don't Make It loudly, clearly showing off his obscure weirdness.
Only 13, and she knows how to nasty.
She's a dirty old mine.
Frank Zappa is fairly well known, but his early stuff is pretty obscure, and very few people had ever heard it, let alone listened to it enough to memorize the words. I listened to this freak sing the song and heard the exasperated sighs and watched the shaking heads of the other people in the van.
If she were my daughter, I'd...
I was the complete opposite of this guy. Quiet and shy and fading into the woodwork. But hearing him sing this anthem of my youth made me so happy that I started singing along from the back of the van.
Mother, my daughter in chocolate syrup.
Startled, he swung around and stared at me. I looked him in the eye and kept singing. Grinning, he continued, and we sang a loud duet, much to the consternation of the others on the van. I was grinning at the absurdity of the situation and flooded with joyful memories of Ace.
Time to go home. Madge is on the phone.
Gotta meet the gurney.
The driver got in just as we were nearing the end, and stared slack-jawed and stupefied as we screamed out,
TV dinner by the pool, I'm so glad I finished school.
Mr. Weirdo spun back around in his seat and stared out the window, and I calmly opened up my book and continued reading, glowing with nostalgia. The driver shook his head, muttered, college kids, and swung the van out onto the snowy road, Hampshire bound.